You're listening to Dig Deep, KAXE, KBXE. It's a conversation between conservative Chuck Marrone and liberal Aaron Brown. This time we are talking about election 2020, and we're kind of taking a look at the behind the scenes, why things are happening, what the messages might mean. And we're going to start at kind of Iowa. And
yeah. Well, I just got back from the state fair. I don't know if the two of you went to the state fair.
Not this year.
Oh, there's two women who have stolen my heart. My wife and sweet Martha. Oh. And
a bucket of cookies.
So I have to make my annual pilgrimage. There's a little bit of politics, obviously, at the state fair. I kind of intentionally stayed away from it this year. And it's the frame of mind I'm in. And I kind of feel like we've created now this society where there is this group that is very motivated by it, but there's this growing group who are not passive about it. Like, okay, well, I'll listen and I'll pay attention, but I've actually taken the step that I've taken in many ways and said, I'm going to distance myself from it. Like if I see politics in something, I'm going to intentionally give myself space. If you're in Iowa, you don't get the chance to do that. Iowa is the first in the country caucus state, primary state. There's a lot of discussion, especially among Democrats, of how that's not a great plan because Iowa's not representative of the country as a whole. Okay, fine. But the process that we've had for a long time now is that you would do Iowa, you would do New Hampshire, you would do South Carolina as a kind of trifecta way to kick off a voting season, those three being maybe a little bit more together as a cluster, more indicative of the electoral spirit of the country. So we've mobilized all these people now, particularly on the Democratic side of the aisle, to places like Iowa and New Hampshire, and to a lesser extent, South Carolina, to start testing their messages out. How is this going to play? Can I mobilize people to show up? Can I mobilize people to give me $5 and $10? Can I mobilize people to sign my email list and build basically this machine? And we're starting to see now the fruition of basically a year and a half of doing that.
Right. And it's been out of the public eye, a lot of this. Like, most people sitting at home don't know, what the actual organization is. And a lot of those fruits, like you mentioned, the email lists and the donor lists, things like that are very valuable in the political world. But sitting at home, you wouldn't necessarily make a decision on who to support based on that. However, that ends up being really critical in terms of who is standing there when you are making your decision as to who to support. And you've seen this maybe on the local level, just to compare it. Back in 2018, when the DFL had their primary for the open congressional seat, the Republicans had already basically picked who their nominee was going to be, and the Democrats were fighting it out for a spot. Well, you could think, oh, there's four or five candidates, which one will win? Well, not surprisingly, the one who won was the one who had formed the most traditional political organization that had the ability to raise money, which allows you to run advertising and hire workers. And that's pretty typical in campaigns in both parties all over the country. On the presidential level, though, we're dealing with a whole new set of numbers. It's one thing to raise $10 million and maybe you can run a state campaign on $10 million. It's a little low, actually, for a state campaign now. But $10 million is a lot of money. That's nothing for a presidential candidate. That's not even a good quarter of fundraising. So you've got to figure out how to scale up. If you have a platform, a well-known national figure, you have huge advantages because you have the name recognition. And so the biggest donors are going to see you as viable. But if you're a senator from a small Midwestern state, let's say, or somebody who's maybe a little more obscure, but you have a high ambition and hopes that you'll stand out as a unique candidate, and there's a lot of candidates that would describe on the Democratic side this year, then you've really got to scale up very, very quickly. That's a challenge. It's almost like a marketing challenge more than it is a policy political challenge. If I make a sugar water and I put it in a can, how do I get people to buy it? And that's really what's happening now, is how do you get investors to invest in your sugar water?
You're really, at this point, looking at candidates as a venture capitalist would.
Yeah.
So what's the big difference between Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren? When we get into the things that I think you would look for in a presidential candidate, Are they both super intelligent? Yes. Are they both electable? Yes. Are they both charismatic? Yes. Mm-hmm. Do they both have well-developed policy positions? Yes. Are they both centrist in some ways, but appealing to the Democratic base in critical other ways? Yes. The difference between the two of them right now is that one has built this very broad machine. Mm-hmm. It might not be super deep, but it's very broad.
And you're speaking of Elizabeth Warren, who is doing better right now and is one of the top three candidates in the polling. And our own Senator Klobuchar, who, like you say, is similar in many ways in terms of professional profile, is way back in the middle of the pack, you know, barely registering in a lot of polls. And what I would say is Elizabeth Warren has created essentially a message, a marketing message, an image of herself that is both plausibly real, her, and appealing to a large number of people. I've got a plan for that, is her thing. Everybody's trying to think of the catchphrase that is going to be the thing that propels the winning candidate. Clearly, Warren is getting more play for hers. Better marketing. She's invested in early state organization rather than 50-state strategy. Well, what that did is it got her a lot of attention where the journalists were, which is the early states. And now, and plus, I think she's just created more of a profile for herself. And I'm not trying to shill for her or anything or any other candidate. It's just you can see how Elizabeth Warren's early success is a marketing success.
Again, if you get back to the venture capital idea, if you look at your early support, if you look at your support as the capital that I'm spending on a campaign.
Confidence, I guess.
Confidence. You would say, well, if I have to pick between one of these 15 or 20 candidates, I could pick Amy Klobuchar, and she certainly looks like an attractive candidate to me, or I could pick Elizabeth Warren because she looks like a very similar attractive candidate to me. Wow, this one seems like it has higher upside potential. And so what you see is that at this point in the campaign, you're starting to, in a sense, and maybe it's unfair, but you're starting to aggregate not winners and losers, but you're starting to aggregate losers, people who are not going to, in a sense, make the cut. And the cut might be the next debate. If you're not on the stage, you don't matter. You're not there. It may be, you know, the capacity to show up in the next straw poll. At some point, what you start to see, and we saw this 4 years ago with the Republicans and Tim Pawlenty. Tim Pawlenty didn't even make it to the Iowa caucuses because it just became clear, like, I'm never going to get the momentum I need to be a serious person in this arena.
Yeah, even though he had, there was a lot of, parlor talk about how Tim Pawlenty was the perfect candidate.
Should have been vice president instead of Sarah Palin.
Right. And all this. And he was like this perfect Republican candidate. And that was 2012 that he ran. And he had left the governor's office to run. And it was like a big, sacrifice he made. He might have been reelected. Like you said, he didn't even get to the Iowa caucuses. We're not sure that Amy Klobuchar is going to get to the Iowa caucuses in 2020. Now, I don't want to knock her, but like we're getting to the point now where we're watching in this shadow primary, which is not people voting, not regular people voting. That doesn't even really matter right now. And your response to telephone polls, if you get a pollster's call, you are probably one of the most important people on the planet. Because has a huge impact, but we're watching this kind of coalition building thing happen on the front end before the voters have their say, which is the American system. So if voters are pushing for a certain policy, sometimes the policies can become their own kind of marketing. But it's not exclusively, okay, who's the most liberal, who's the least liberal, let's pick one in the middle. I'm a moderate Democrat, so I'm going to pick a centrist Democrat. Okay, well, there are voters who might think that and act that way. But what does that mean exactly? And how do you distinguish among, say, four or five candidates who might be of that description? And I don't think a lot of people are making ideological decisions about that. It comes down to who are the candidates I know, the Pepsis and the Cokes of this thing. Am I willing to take a chance on a non-Pepsi or Coke, an RC Cola candidate, or a Shasta candidate?
Shasta, yeah.
Or a home-brewed soda water candidate? You know, or am I just going to buy a Pepsi or a Coke, a Biden or a Sanders, or maybe a Warren? Well,
this is why, and I'm going to sound more like I'm following it when I'm really not that closely, mm-hmm. but I have heard the name Andrew Yang many times.
Yeah. And in our circles, we've been hearing Andrew Yang because...
Is it our age?
Our age and the fact that we're fancy thinking people make money talking for a living.
Right.
Yeah.
Because what Andrew Yang has done is he has, in a sense, mobilized around a few, like the universal basic income is one of mm-hmm. his things.
Right.
And what he's been able to do is frame these things in a certain way where he's kind of latched on to, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm getting this on the side, but he feels like he's almost tapped into like the tech bro libertarian side of the Democrat Party, right. is like, let's try a bunch of new initiatives and see what right. works. And he's kind of like the thinker.
I would equate him to Bitcoin.
He's like the Bitcoin candidate.
He's the Bitcoin candidate. I don't know if he'd want to be called that, but maybe Bitcoin is what we're all going to use in the future, Chuck.
Yeah,
maybe.
He could be just ahead of his time.
I got a buddy who's
Andrew Yang, and as the Bitcoin candidate, what he has done is he's distinguished himself mm-hmm. from this large pack of essentially indistinguishable people. And so even though I think he's way less electable than Amy Klobuchar. I think he's way less probably presidential than Amy Klobuchar. I'm sounding like a shill for Amy Klobuchar.
No.
But I'm using her as like vanilla and like everyone yeah. else is like...
But that vanilla is precisely the problem she's had.
It's exactly the problem she's had.
It's everything that she... would make her a great candidate. I actually know Amy Klobuchar a little. And so she would be, I'll just say this in my opinion, a good president. Okay. But there are a lot of people who would be good presidents.
Is she a good candidate?
And
that's a big...
And being a good candidate, though, and even right. though she can do the deeds of a candidate well, she can speak well. She is a good debater, not a bad debater. She can raise some money, you know. All of these things are good, so why isn't Amy Klobuchar in the top three or four? And it's because she can't stand out.
Right. And so Andrew Yang will be on stage for the debate.
Yeah.
But largely because he's got a shtick that is able to get above a certain threshold of mm-hmm. people who will show up and say, I support Andrew Yang. Yeah. And that's it's interesting because you can turn a shtick into a campaign. We have a president right now who successfully did that 4 years ago. You know, our president is not really an American citizen. There were a whole bunch of like early things that he yeah. said that he ultimately backed away from and didn't really make core to what he was, but it got him in the door, got him to yeah. a certain level where he could be in the game.
Build the walls. These Build kind the, of,
yeah.
And that's what they were, is their marketing concepts. And he is a way better marketer than a businessman, but that's kind of how he came to be a person we even know about.
Right. So you have on the Democratic side, the Biden and the Sanders, the Coke and Pepsi. You've got Elizabeth Warren, who's maybe the slightly off brand, but yet,
Sprite.
You know, has Sprite. Yeah. But is well enough known. And then you've got the Andrew Yang, who is the Bitcoin candidate, I think is the best way to describe him, mm-hmm. which is kind of using this shtick to become a player. I would put Pete Buttigieg in that yep. as well.
Mayor Pete. And he actually had a little boomlet of success early on, and it was almost all marketing.
Yeah.
You know, because I remember when he announced, and I think you would even post something, either you or Strongtowns or somebody mentioned.
It was me personally.
Yeah, you personally, not Strongtowns, about how you were glad to see him in the race or something because you had worked
with I know him personally.
Yeah, you knew him.
Yeah, I do.
And I didn't know him, but I had read about him, and there's something I would call him kind of like the new generation kind of style of politics. A lot of what you and I talk about were the things that Pete Buttigieg talks about. And I thought, well, this is kind of an interesting candidate.
Somebody he could actually different. Be the third wheel on Dig Deep and do really well.
If he were sitting here right now, he'd have these conversations and one or both of us would be out of a job, you know?
Yeah.
Again, another thinking person's candidate for you, but he had a little boomlet. He even surged up into the mid-teens in the polls for a while. And people thought, oh, maybe we need to go with a small city mayor, you know, something totally out of the... And he became kind of a... that alternate, and he's dropped in the polls, but he raised a lot of money during that time, and for that reason alone, he's still hanging around.
Right.
He's still in the mix.
Right.
So with President Trump, we saw that kind of any attention, any social media, anything was good, even if it was bad. Is that still the case? Is that a big part of this, people trying to get attention?
You see the some of the cultural differences, though, between the Republican and the Democratic Party, though.
For the Republican, it's a badge of honor to have the New York Times trash you. And for Democrats, it would be a point of shame.
Yeah, if the New York Times said you are unfit for office, a Democrat would feel that that was a bad thing.
Right. For Republicans, it's like...
Republicans, you know. Yeah, it might be an annoying thing, or, you know, if you're in a close election or something, you'd say that's not good. But you don't think like you need the New York Times' approval. In fact, the New York Times, rightly or wrongly, represents what you think is wrong with everything. So that was the key to Donald Trump's success in that insurgent campaign, is he got to break all the political norms, and the people who would vote for him, the 48 point however many percent or whatever percent nationally voted for Donald Trump, that was exactly as many votes as he needed to win that election, they were going to stick. He either guessed or lucked out that they were going to stick with him, and not only that, they were going to turn out in greater numbers because of him behaving that way. Whereas on the other side, in the Democratic side, I think Democrats are a little more collectivist by nature, and so fitting in with the group and being a good citizen of the group is a little more valuable trait, I think. And as a result, you see a little less willingness to go negative. If I'm one of these 20 candidates, if I'm number 14 out of 20, you know, and I'm not as bad as some of those ones who are dropping out, but man, I have a long way to go to get to number one, I'd be throwing bombs, right? Wouldn't you be, like, if you were in a race or an athletic competition of some kind and you were down by that much, you'd be trying things. Well, they're kind of worried about, you know, they don't want to hurt the eventual nominee if it's not them, which is probably a good thing. And they don't want to hurt their chances to be the running mate or to have a cabinet position or something else in what they feel will be a Democratic administration. So see the differences there. Obviously, Donald Trump 4 years ago didn't care about any of that and laid waste to those notions. That's the difference between the Democratic and Republican parties right now. It's not just the policy differences, which are obvious and can be identified, but it's the cultural difference in how they campaign and what they value. And that is very evident in this campaign.
So what are Republicans, what are conservatives, are they going to do? Are they going to follow President Trump? Does it matter who the Democratic nominee ends up being? I know we're not hearing as much about Republicans right now because there's so much happening with the Democratic side.
There's already two challengers who have stepped forward and said, we're going to contest this in the primary. I think that there is not likely to be any more, certainly not any that are going to be credible. And I think a big part of that is because the Republican Party has shifted. Donald Trump's ascendancy within the Republican Party was a coup of the party. It was a takeover of the party from what the established Republican Party was. And that was, you know, part of the reaction of establishment Republicans to Trump has been, you know, the Never Trump movement. You know, he's not my president and all that. There's a schism in the party. And the thing about the Republican Party right now is that from where I'm sitting and I'm looking at it, and I'm not like deeply involved in the day-to-day of it, Republicans have, what was the old saying about the Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line? Mm-hmm. Republicans do tend to, for whatever reason, be more of a party of falling in line. And I think the big question you're going to have as a Republican in the next election is not, are we going to support Donald Trump in a primary? It's going to be, do I cross the president and risk the fallout from that if he were to win again? Do I separate myself from the president because I plan to be here after he's gone? Or do I take my thing and go somewhere else? I see a lot of Republicans now retiring, saying I'm not going to run again. I think we're up to 15 now.
And they are generally the veteran Republican Congress people from suburban.
Yeah.
You know, they might be conservative districts, but they're not, they're, you know, classically Republican districts, not the newer Republican districts.
Right. And so I feel like for a person who understands that and sit, you know, I did not vote for Donald Trump. I've not been secret about that. I'm not enthusiastic about Trump second term. But I absolutely do not want Bernie Sanders to be president. I'm not a fan of the Democratic Party. I think the open question for me is there some other, I don't even want to call it a third party, but is there some other option that's made available to people like that.
And there was 4 years ago or 3 years ago.
In the Libertarian Party?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of.
And, right.
I mean, Gary Johnson never took off and was never going to win, but a lot of people who voted for him were conservatives who didn't want to vote for Trump.
Right. But when you go down, I mean, get past Biden and go to the next round of, the Sanders, Warren, and so on. You're talking about Medicaid for all, free college education, potential for reparations. There's a whole long list of, Green New Deal. There's a whole long list of very outside the mainstream, quite radical policies that is like the uniform dogma of that part of the party. And I think the question becomes, if they go there and Trump is where he's at, that leaves not just a space in the middle, that leaves this broad chasm in the middle. Does something fill that? And, 4 years ago, there was a push for what would be like a unity party in America. There would be a Democrat and a Republican centrist say, we'll work together and we'll have this
unity party. Sam Waterston cut ads for it.
Yeah. It went away because it gained no momentum.
Right.
It's really hard in this country for a third party to get credibility. Will there be that kind of thing again? And it's way too early to say.
I think not.
I think not, too.
And I think people will have to make a binary choice between probably Biden, Warren, or Sanders, or candidate X, who's one of the others who magically appears, floats above something for some reason. And we'll have to make a choice between that person and a slightly more liberal than in the past agenda for the Democratic Party. And then Donald Trump, who is Donald Trump, and is the white, hot, oxygen-sucking, imploding supernova of everything.
Right.
We'll talk more. This is Dig Deep. We'll talk more about elections, how they work, what's happening right now for 2020.